I'm John Kroll. Today, on this special recorded No Limits, we're going to celebrate National Poetry Month, which is April. We're going to be talking with some Indiana poets about their work and hearing their work. My guests are Mitchell L.H. Douglas, author of Dying in the Scarecrow's Arms, Allison Horton, author of Quickfire, Jessica Reed, author of World Composed, and Chris Forehand, author of Black Leapt In. Because this is a recorded program, we're not going to be able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media. But we do hope you enjoy the conversation and the poetry. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. Today is a special recorded No Limits. We're going to be talking, because April is National Poetry Month, we are going to be talking with some of Indiana's poets about their work. We're going to be hearing some of the work. But because this is a recorded program, that means that we cannot take phone calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media. I think you're going to enjoy both the conversation and hearing this work. My guests are all poets. Mitchell H. Douglas, who is the author of Dying in the Scarecrow's Arms. Allison Horton, author of Quick Fire. Jessica Reed, author of World Composed. And Chris Forehand of Black Leapt In. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. So I'll start with Mitchell first. I think the backgrounds, I'm always fascinated by how people arrive at any decision to do a creative act. What led you to poetry as at least one of your chosen forms?
It's a good question. I think I was feeling really isolated as a kid after I moved from Louisville, Kentucky to Iowa City, Iowa, and met people that were kind of led me to like the local punk scene there. And that was kind of like the first time where I felt like there was some kind of ownership in my place there and what I was doing. So I was a little 9-year-old kid listening to The Clash, and then that led to the local shows, and I started listening to the music, and I started writing short poems that were like the short songs that I heard. And I think, after that, I was kind of, I was hooked. And that started my relationship with poetry.
Jessica, how about you?
Always interested in language, but I studied physics for my bachelor's degree, and physics is a really strange, there's a strange world that physics reveals, and mm-hmm. I think I just, everyday language is ill-equipped, and poetry seems to give me a way to talk about things that can't really be talked about in normal language. So.
Well, I know, they say that, math and music and poetry all come from the same part of the brain? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Physics too, apparently, or is that...
I think there's a lot of crossover. My mentor, Tom Andrews at Purdue, he was a brilliant poet, but he also worked at a math journal, and we used to talk a lot about the crossover between sciences and arts. So.
Okay. So far we have punk and physics leading people to poetry. Allison, what's your story?
Well, I too came to poetry through music. Yeah. I started writing songs, or believing that I was writing songs that mattered. And I have always been drawn to language and to storytelling, even if the story seemed to be ahead of my time. I liked the way words are put together. And I just decided to try my hand at writing a little verse. And I think that it also was a way for a young black girl like myself to have a certain voice, I grew up in a household where it was kind of understood that you are, that children are seen and not heard. And so those thoughts, those observations, those feelings have to go somewhere. And poetry was a good place for me in that case.
Chris, how about you? I know we've had you on the show before.
Yeah, and I'd like to give you a different answer just to mix things up, but I got to tell the truth. There's a musical connection for me, too. Before I was writing poems, I think I was writing songs when I was a teenager. Obviously, there was something about music that got me in touch with things, as I think Allison or Jessica was saying, that you can't be spoken of in normal language. But before all that, I think I was just bewildered. I was a little kid who thought, how strange this, how'd I get here? What is this world I'm in? What am I? And I'm constantly filled with wonder about such questions, and that's what the poetry often is about, is trying to articulate these essential mysteries. And so, you know, I've always felt that way, that somehow or another, the basic things I was being asked to do with my life, educate myself, get a job, eat well, exercise, have good relationships with people, all these perfectly wonderful things, that somehow they were secondary to the primary issue of being in a body, having a mind and imagination, and having these feelings. And poetry is the only way I've found that I'm capable of, anyway, of remaining in touch with that essential bewilderment and honoring it.
Now, you talk about all these other ways, and I'm going to revisit this subject with the rest of you earlier, but I'm going to pick on Chris and have him read his poetry first. But you talk about how you had to explore some of these other paths. Did you try other forms of expression, and do you recall the moment that you thought, oh, wow, poetry, this is the one that speaks to me?
It wasn't a moment. It was a kind of slow recognition. As I say, when I was an adolescent, a teenager, I was writing songs, and they were mainly just for myself. I wasn't performing them for other people. It was a way of, you know, finding some sense of, you know, being in accord with reality, finding a way to keep my sanity. But, you know, I really loved broadcasting. I was on the radio in high school. We had a high school radio station in Seattle. I remained on the radio into college. We had an NPR station, and I worked for the NPR station. And
God bless you.
And I was training myself to be a broadcaster, and I became a broadcast journalist. I became a TV reporter. But about halfway through my college years, I realized what I really loved was poetry. You know, I'd loved it in high school, and in college I'd found the poetry classes and the poetry professor and the other poets, and that's where my real joy was coming from. But it didn't cross my mind that that would in any way help me pay the rent. So I continued into the world of broadcasting, and I did feel I was expressing myself in broadcasting. I did enjoy writing and speaking on the radio and television, but it wasn't expressing what I can express in poetry. And so 3 years into my career as a TV journalist, I realized this isn't working. I've got to quit and go back to school. So it was a slow recognition, but then there was that final sudden break where I just quit my career and started over again, as it were, by going back to graduate school to study poetry. And it's, other than deciding to marry my wife, it was the best decision I ever made.
So let me ask a specific question. When you sort of said, oh, I'm going to leave this career and, you know, I mean, finding work in broadcast, television as a television reporter is not effortless, so you obviously had to have had some success doing that, and said, in effect, oh, I'm going to be a poet instead. what was the reaction?
Speaking of bewilderment, most people in my life had no idea what to make of that. But my mother, you know, God bless her soul, was completely supportive, because it's just her general rule to allow people to do what they need to do to make themselves happy. But, you know, I think she had a little concern that I was, in essence, starting from scratch. I had no sense of what I would do for a living with a degree in creative writing. I ended up being a teacher, as many people do, right? Mm-hmm. So I do feel I had support, you know, from my family, but it's not that a lot of people in my life really understood why I would be compelled to do what I did.
Yeah, whenever I get together with other people who write, I'm always reminded of, I think, the greatest greatest line, and it's from an Elmore Leonard novel, Get Shorty, that only writers get. One of the characters in that book asks, what kind of writing pays best? And the other one responds, ransom notes. Only people who had to write for a living really appreciate the humor and the pain involved in that story. So, Chris, I'm going to ask you now if you wouldn't mind to share a little bit of your work with us.
Sure. And I was wondering whether I should there are two kinds of poems I've got here in front of me. And one is to the degree that I'm capable of writing such a poem of social consciousness. And then the other kind of poem is a poem more navel-gazing, personal consciousness. And I think I'll read the social consciousness one. Why not? It is that time. One of the things I was thinking about with poetry is the poetic imagination, or imagination in general, is so important as a means to empathy. Putting yourself outside of yourself and trying to get into other people's skin. And it seems, that is always crucial in human civilization. It feels especially important these days that people honor that need to consider other people's experiences. And, Whitman, one of our great American forefathers, in Song of Myself, his long poem, he wrote, "Whoever walks a furlong without sympathy walks to his own funeral, dressed in his shroud." In other words, here's our great poet saying, without sympathy, we're dead. So here's a poem that is about that, it seems to me, and I've got it keyed to a particular time, January 2017. It's called Old Mad Blind Despised. Old Mad Blind Despised, which is a quote from a Percy Shelley poem about a complaint about the English king, George III, in the early 19th century. And this is a complaint about a more recent leader. And I'll try to be fairly quick about this, but I should say that it's a kind of hinge poem. It has two halves, and the second half switches completely into a memory of high school, which becomes my analogy. Okay, old, mad, blind, despised. "There ought to be a way to hymn ourselves out of this. Get down to hard bargaining in song, as in the days of gingham and stained Stetsons and mules muscling plows through the rain. So the jelly factory failed. So a teenage girl braved the swollen river to get here, hungry baby in a bundle on her head. We must have been dead, asleep. Or dizzy, must have ravened secretly for grief's deep kiss to make the creepy neighbor dad our king. A strutting smirk, he laughed when no one else was laughing, pushed his kid in the swing too high till she squealed in fear. He's boss of us all now, a sallow broth boiled down to a gloat and a crown. One of us, write a psalm, quick. A plea will heave skyward out of this world that's begun to feel like my high school typing class. We sat feet flat on the floor, fingers arched, touch typing clean from drafts, letters among record executives scheming to sign a hot rock guitarist with the goods. We were kids. We'd dig it, the idea was, this talk of dollars and deals behind the kind of music that shattered our hearts with happiness. I understood I was being condescended to, shrunken to a size an anxious hunch had told me I was already, and I might have complained had I known what to say and to whom. And known it was my place to do so, and had I not been acting as instructed, training my eyes on the page I had been given, typing as swiftly as I could and true all those words without meaning."
the title of that poem again, Chris?
Old, Mad, Blind, Despised.
Thank you for sharing that with us. That was lovely. And I know we've got to let you go now because you have to go pick up your children, but I'd like to thank you for joining us. We are talking about poetry with some of Indiana's poets here on No Limits today. This is a recorded program, so we're not able to take questions or comments by phone, email, or social media. We hope you're enjoying the conversation and even more the poetry. My guests are Mitchell H. Douglas, author of Dying in the Scarecrow's Arms, Allison Horton, author of Quick Fire, Jessica Reed, author of World Composed, and Chris Foran of Black Leapt In. That was his poetry you just listened to. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about poetry on No Limits with some of Indiana's poets. This is a recorded program, so that means we're not taking questions or comments via phone or email or social media, but we hope you're enjoying both the poetry and the conversation. In the last segment, we heard from Chris Foran, who is the author of Black Leapt In. He had to leave for a good reason. He has to go pick up his children. But we are joined now by Jessica Reed. She is the author of World Composed, Allison Horton, the author of Quick Fire, and Mitchell L.H. Douglas, the author of Dying in the Scarecrow's Arms. So I'm going to ask Allison, I'll start with you. Same question I asked Chris. You know, we all work through kind of different forms and find different places of expression. Do you recall the moment or the period when you realized that that poetry was one that spoke to you and spoke powerfully?
That's a good question. The moment that poetry spoke to me and spoke powerfully.
If there was a period, he said, obviously, it was more a progression and was kind of wandering through and realizing other things weren't making him happy. But that's his story. It's not your story.
Right. I immersed myself in music when I was a kid.
Okay.
So I think that as a form of expression, being able to write the things that I held inside and to have a place where I could hold those things, whether it was a journal or a poem that I kept to myself. I always felt that it was important to at least store it someplace. I didn't have a listening audience then. I also thought I wanted to be a singer at one time. And so when I would take to songwriting, I felt like I was kind of giving voice to my story or my feelings through that particular medium. But I also grew up against the landscape of hip hop, and so poetry and music married in such a way certainly fascinated me. So in comes the rhyme and the larger issues. Also, I feel that pop culture has been important in my development as a poet. And so I feel that intersecting a number of interests of mine with the idea of language and poetry also allowed me to have an outlet. High school welcomed my poetry. So I think being able to enter talent shows and get a good response also let me know what it meant to say something of meaning in front of others and get a particular response. And I've always looked at this world in a very serious manner because I grew up Jehovah's Witness, at least that's what my parents chose. And that's very much in contrast with that particular belief system. drawing oneself to the world, which I actually began to draw myself more into the world because it had been set off in a different space from what I had access to. So there's this intrigue and there's this wonder and this curiosity, and in comes the questions. And so poetry welcomes these questions and sometimes attempts to provide answers in some ways, or at least raise more questions. So
I'd like to ask you if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit of your work with us.
Sure. I don't mind at all. First question comes to mind for me as a poet is some of the stories I have been given, even biblically, like, for instance, the story of Eve. Mm-hmm. And so the first poem I will read actually opens my book. It's entitled Understanding Eve. And I try to reimagine Eve in a way that is accessible to me in my woman walk, in my skin, and in my understanding of the world. So I'd like to share Understanding Eve.
Okay.
I mean, to put it all on Satan might be a little unfair, considering the fact that a woman has her own mind, her own set of ribs, her own eyes for examining both sides of a fig leaf, nose for sensing fire in a single drop of rain, her own lips for speaking when asked for directions, brain for deciding left or right, a body bearing its own garden of lush fruits, and besides his, her own breath coursing through each flared nostril, own cravings scratching at the surface of her earth-brown rainbow skin, own teeth perfect for chewing the fat with a serpent, her own seeds planted in hidden places, her own dark voices, caprices coiling inside, her own solutions to curing mass ignorance, climate change, pre-inflation theories, and doubling the learning capacity of children, her own reasons for not eating the waxed skin of an apple, and wouldn't you say, her own ideas on how to get to the core.
Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
With us. And the title again is Understanding Eve.
Understanding Eve.
We're going to have another go around, and I want to hear more poetry. I also want to ask Jessica the same question that I asked Chris. You know, as you worked your way through these the possible forms of self-expression, what was there a moment or a period when you realized, okay, poetry speaks to me really, really powerfully?
Yeah, so also for me, I don't think that there was one moment, but
not the eureka moment or
right.
Whatever. Yeah.
But I'm an extremely neurotic person, and every time I say something, I immediately question it and doubt it, and can figure all kinds of alternatives, and I feel like poetry allows me to write in other voices. It allows me to enter in a lot of different voices. And also Allison mentioned questioning and the role of questions. And I feel like that's an important part of poetry too. So it allows me to speak in a way that I don't feel the pressure of making claims, you know, declaratives that I have to stand behind and defend. You know, it's just a way to let in a lot of different voices and play, really. So it's true.
So again, the same sort of thing. Is there some work that you would be willing to share with us today?
Sure.
Okay. What are you going to read for us?
Okay. This is called Late Summer in Indiana, as the Earth passes once again through a band of comet debris.
The physics here, I can see. Yeah.
So, on a Perseid night, each meteor spends itself. Every day, the field asks me for nothing. August, each year I have showered in them fragments of swift tuttle. I didn't notice in December 1992 when the parent comet was nearest the sun, as I learn it was July 1862 and will be August 21, 26, my whole life in the gaping between. This summer we saw weather, lightning dispatches from the next world, striking because we heard nothing. The sky, an overturned bowl of gray, the entire horizon south to east, unvanishing. Streaks of electric light, silver threads stitching and unstitching, not us. Storms we could see, but we're not in. You wait your whole life for that kind of view. The actual, showcasing its branched meanings, silenced and caught equivocating. One has to draw diagrams, slice space through orbital planes to clarify how another's path knifes through ours. It is enough to inhabit one's orbit, to fix one point in the relative unfixed. The radiant point slides as we turn on our axis, drifts against the background stars as we orbit the sun. I've become a spectator of the known, of the observable universe of black-eyed Susans, milkweed, coneflowers, fireflies, and Queen Anne's lace, staring each day, each year, until I recognize it, scope, union, and star system sense.
And the title of that again is?
That's Late Summer in Indiana as the Earth Passes Once Again Through a Band of Comet Debris.
Yeah, the other others I could remember fairly easily, but this
it's
one.
A long title.
Yeah. Yes. Well, thank you for sharing that.
You're very welcome.
Mitchell, I'm going to sort of complete the circuit here by asking the same question here. Was there a period or a moment on your path to kind of self-discovery when you thought, okay, poetry is something that speaks to me powerfully?
You know, I just realized that I had a very similar moment to Chris. And Chris, leaving broadcast journalism, I left editorial journalism. I was a newspaper reporter and editor in Kentucky right after getting out of undergrad at the University of Kentucky. And I worked in Bardstown and E-Town and Georgetown. And, you know, I was so engaged as a reporter that I started to see my friends from college were all of a sudden writing books. And I was looking at them. And as a student at the University of Kentucky, I co-founded an organization called the Appalachian Poets in 1991. And I saw them writing books and appearing in anthologies. And I was kind of like, I think I want to do that and change things around. So I had to stop a career as a journalist and go back. Went to grad school, studied poetry, and led me to where I am today, which is it took me a little while. I learned things the hard way on a regular basis. So that's just part of who
many,
I am.
Many writers do. That's part of what makes us writers, I think.
Yeah, I have to spend some time doing some other things before I go, oh, okay, that's what I should be doing. But it was clear, and I just had such a great time in graduate school that to take all those days writing poetry and studying poetry and talking to poetry, you know, with other people was a joy, really. And that started at the University of Louisville. And then went to Bloomington. I had a teacher, Paul Greiner, a novelist, University of Louisville, said, you know, have you thought about an MFA? And I was like, no, I haven't thought about an MFA because U of L didn't have one. So I applied to IU Bloomington and got in and just really had a really good time there studying with Kevin Young, who, of course, now is at the Schomburg in New York. So.
Do you have some work you would be willing to share with us?
I do. I started, changed a class I teach at IUPUI. I changed it around to start the semester in the city out of the classroom. And I wanted to get my students in the streets of Indianapolis and writing about what they saw. And on a day that we went to the circle, I just happened to start to write with them. I always write with my students. And so I came up with a poem called Circle, and it begins with an epigraph you'll recognize that's at least the title of the new book. And the road twisted onto his loveless house and his cornfield dying in the scarecrow's arms. Robert Hayden. Today the sun has fists, not rays. Nothing delicate happens here. Watch the beating that goes ignored, the circle, evening, the monument and call of war. A common Indiana roof with the ranch ripped off. A common Indiana ranch with the roof ripped off. Baruch says Midwest is sieve, pass through, permanently in transit, flux. It is the get here to get there, the sun's mapped fists in an orange 6 o'clock beatdown, the tenants strewn about the concrete circumference, liquid in states of rest, skin and bone poured over the curb of South Meridian, splayed beneath a mailbox, propped against a garbage can outside. The suits and walkers' heads turn, sidestepping the future they escaped, eyes on a latte, the next block. Today the sun has a better haymaker, a better uppercut, a wicked right-left combo. Today the sun is perfecting its roundhouse, and the size 14 keeps connecting left jaw, right jaw. You would cry, but there's no layaway for tears. So you cuddle up on an asphalt couch next to your brothers and sisters, the styrofoam maracas and cups and change lulling you to rest like the pluck of kalimbas and turning signals, the bass lines, car horns hang in exhaust, cruising through your living room on an airless city night.
And the title of that again is?
That is Circle.
Circle. So I want to ask each of you, now that we've heard a little bit, what are the satisfactions that you draw from first writing a poem and then, you know, poetry, at least to my mind, at some level has to be spoken for it really to come alive, from writing it and then reading it aloud? I'll start with Mitchell on that one.
I think that's definitely, and that's one of the things I tell my students, you know, it's when you're thinking about poetry, and I always think about the Black Mountain Poets and Charles Olson and this idea of projective verse, that, you know, the poetry is of the body and it's of the breath and it drives the poem. You're going to connect with the poem in a much different way if you hear it than just reading it. And so part of our study is always, you know, not only a discussion of a poem that we read of the day, but to hear it, you know, and think about that, you know, and that just makes a world of difference in the way that you appreciate a poem, I think, hearing that music.
Jessica.
So I think for me, the satisfaction probably comes from the surprise. That is when, you know, when I sit down to write, I think I might think that I know where the poem is going to go and I have certain mm-hmm. expectations, but if it comes out the way I thought it was going to come out, then it's probably a failure. And so the most satisfaction I get is when it takes a turn and does something that I didn't expect to happen. So
it's like a voyage of discovery
yeah.
on some level.
Yeah, there's a process to it, and it's rewarding when you find out something new. Yeah.
Allison.
I think for me the most rewarding aspect is the reciprocity of art, the give and take, the call and response. That you get from your audience, that feeling that you have written something and somebody has received it. And in many ways, an audience will let you know that they have received it. And that means something. It's kind of, I think, why we do this. It's not just ours to hold and contain. It is to be shared and received in some way. And that means something to me, especially when somebody comments on my work specifically or even critically afterwards.
We are talking about poetry here on No Limits today. April is National Poetry Month, so every year we try to do a show on poetry and Indiana poets. This is a recorded program, so that means we're not taking calls today. We're not taking emails. We're not taking questions or comments via social media, but we hope that you are enjoying the conversation with three of Indiana's poets now. Jessica Reed, author of World Composed, Allison Horton, author of Quick Fire, and Mitchell L.H. Douglas, author of Dying in the Scarecrow's Arms. Again, this is a recorded program. That means we're not taking calls or emails or messages via Facebook or Twitter, but we are going to be hearing a lot more from Indiana's poets. We're going to hear more of their poetry and talk with them more about the process after this break. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today on No Limits, in the special recorded No Limits, about poetry in honor of National Poetry Month. Because this is a recorded program, that means we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media. But we hope you're enjoying the conversation, and even more, hope you're enjoying hearing the poetry from three of Indiana's poets. We're going to be hearing some more in this segment from Mitchell L.H. Douglas. He is the author of Dying in the Scarecrow's Arms, Allison Horton, author of Quick Fire, and Jessica Reed, author of World Composed. So I'm going to move the conversation. We're going to hear more of the poetry. But, Jessica, I wanted to – I'm going to ask each of you, but I'm going to pick on Jessica first and ask, how does the process start for you? Where does the creative impulse begin?
It begins by reading other poets, really, for me. For me, it's I think of writing as being part of a larger conversation, and there's – when I read, there's a voice that is speaking to me, and if I'm really moved, then I want to enter that conversation. I want to write myself. So that's where it starts, is reading someone else, and then I feel moved to sit and write.
Who are the poets that move you the most?
Actually, I mentioned Tom already. Tom was my mentor at Purdue. He passed away in 2001, and it's a kind of a poignant time for me because my first book is coming out, and I'm thinking about him a lot because it would have been good for him to have been here. And he was a really influential poet. And yesterday I dove back into his work and reread a lot of his work. And he was special. So.
Well, I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. He was a good man.
I've not met him, but I had heard of him, and he was a remarkable figure. I'd like to ask you if you wouldn't mind reading a little bit of, and is there one that, given what you've just told us, that would remind you or speak to Tom and his memory?
Actually, I do have one that mentions Tom and quotes a line from him, so I guess that would be that would be appropriate. Also in this poem, I mentioned Virginia, and that's Virginia Woolf, so I'm quoting a few people here. But okay, this is called Light, Pinned and Singing. I am finally present. As Virginia said, my eyes are hard. Years ago now, in optics lab, my partner's strange pronunciation of frosted glass. We were looking at spectra then, glass-shattered light lines, but I couldn't focus. Those radiant projections, just as dazzling as their sources. The glisten of one borrowed from the other. And elsewhere, gaseous auroras, both southern and strange. They'd been there the whole time. Facts may not shimmer, but they are star-like occasions for metaphor, even if I have to bend them a little. That white celestial thought. Virginia warned us all, the light is fitful. White beams of winter. Wind compresses snow into hard barricades. Shakespeare said fires singe my white head. In kitchen sinks and pressure chambers, we manufacture 14 shimmering forms of ice. See, I believed Tom when he said, there is indeed some light in us. We seek to explain it, lest our own fitful light dissipate, starlike in its collapse, with each photon no longer so startlingly distinct.
What is the title of that again?
Light, Pinned and Singing.
And just again, so that you can pay tribute to your mentor, your mentor was?
Is Tom Andrews.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
I am, Mitchell, I'm going to ask you the same question. Where does the process start for you, or the creative impulse? What spurs it?
I do think reading other poets is important. I also think that poets should stop talking and listen. I think that's the best thing that we can do for ourselves, is to really be the best observers. I always think that you know, maybe we have this third eye that, you know, is giving us a picture of the world that other people don't have. I'm constantly thinking that, like, I feel like I see things differently. Sometimes I hear things in poems, the way that people speak. And so all of that is just a matter of being present wherever I am and noticing kind of like the everyday, you know, things that, you know, can be magical. And the poets that I like, you know, do that. I'm thinking about, you know, Lee Young Lee, who will, you know, take a breakfast situation and, you know, turn it into this magical kind of, you know, flirting between parents that's making this, you know, huge statement just about how special, you know, small gestures are. So I'm moved by things like that. And that is a good example for me, you know, to just kind of slow down and notice the things that are around me and pay attention.
Do you have another poem that you'd be willing to share with us?
I do. Because this poem is so focused on the Midwest and Indianapolis, particularly.
Well, we would be the right location for this.
I said, you know, what's more Indianapolis than Long's Bakery? So this is a poem called Hot Donuts, Long's Bakery. Linda does a double take. Says I remind her of her brother. This is what happens to poets. Conversations out of the blue. The luxury of a face, easy to talk to. I'm sure there are secrets in your hands. The careful measure that picks 24 yeast from the racks to lay gently in a white waxed box. A surprise for my students on the last day of class. The sugar before the bitter. Midnight oil, the A's, the F's. Always a few to deal. My hand growing lighter with no less swing. And there's not a space to be had on this curb, and the hunger in our bellies keeps us rushing the door, and your kind eyes and hands keep searching for soft places to sink our teeth.
The title of that again is?
That is Hot Donuts, Long's Bakery.
And where did that, was it on a visit to Long's?
It was exactly that. And to have somebody that something always strange happens to me as a poet. I think this is like a writer thing. Like people are always asking me for directions. Like, you know, somebody looks at me like he knows where, you know, he knows what he's doing. Let's ask him. But it's just such a funny, you know, situation. And so for someone that works there to say, you know, hey, you remind me of my, you know, my brother, I'm like, wow, you know, and starting this conversation. But then I start to, I think poems always have that, or should always have that outward gesture. So it's more than that, you know, kind of looking at yourself, but you're always also looking at, well, how does this affect other people? And what is this leading to? It's always like the threads that we're finding that help us create metaphor and these conversations that draw people into the poem. And so that day just happened to be a long line at Long's that, you know, turned into a poem. And donuts later for my students, but a poem, more importantly, yeah.
So you got a poem out of it, and the students got donuts, so everyone was happy.
I think everybody wins.
everybody wins. On that one. So, Allison, same question to you. Where does the process start for you, or where does that creative impulse, what strikes it?
What strikes it? I write out of necessity, so there are a number of things that tend to strike it for me. It might be one of my observations of our very society. It might be news of another police brutality incident. It might be a return to my childhood. I have lots of poems about my upbringing and family in this particular collection, and I tend to kind of sit and wait, if you will, for a poem. And I also think it's important to read other poets, mm-hmm. and to listen to other poets and to listen to the everyday individual in our everyday encounters, in our daily walk. There is poetry in so many places, and a lot of times I just wait for it. And my response is usually in the language of poetry.
I want to explore a little bit a couple of things you just said. When you say you write out of necessity, what do you mean by that?
Out of the creative or cultural impulse to voice or give voice to a particular emotion or event or cause or thought or idea. And even when I write in form, I still lean toward the climate of the times. Within that form, I'm still responding to where we are or where I feel we might need to be. Maybe that whole idea of becoming the change you want to see. And so I tend to write it into being or reflect that which is not.
That is not, okay.
That is not,
okay.
Yes.
And then the other thing that you said that intrigued me is you say you have to wait for it. Is that as if the poem has to reveal itself to you, or?
Exactly. Allison and deadlines when it comes to, let's say, poetry, or certainly in graduate school, writing exercises and having to fit into that moment, not necessarily be called to it. Mm-hmm. I try to wait to be called to say something that matters or that I feel matters and that I think might matter to others. That's my process so far. Not that I can't write or by a deadline or be given a topic or tailor a poem. I think that in terms of my process, my personal process, it happens when it happens. And it's usually inspired by opening the work of a poet I admire. Mm-hmm. You know, when I fall into this idea of a writer's block, which I don't necessarily subscribe to, pick up a newspaper and find a story to retell or to draw something out of that story that hasn't been drawn already. But I think that certainly reading some of your favorite poets will get the wheels spinning again. Lucille Clifton, Mari Evans, Langston Hughes,
well,
lots of people.
I will ask then, would you share another poem with us?
I will. Since I mentioned Langston Hughes.
Okay.
Who did some really amazing things with his poetry and music, blues and jazz. I'll read a poem called Charlie's Horn. Charlie's Horn. What now will become of me, who today finds no anchor in the slipshoddiness of language, nothing to avert the curse of autumnal winds, nothing in this world to seduce or chronicle in a foreign tongue, nothing dancing on the rooftop, nothing drumming me back home, no polyrhythmic tides washing me to shore, no grandiose flood sent to trouble the waters down here, no rescue through the biblical blowhole of a large white fish, no muse picking the locks on doors to rooms where the keys have been missing for weeks. A friend tells me I could turn to jazz and wait for a cool breeze or a dizzying blast of bebop, unleashing a manic chain reaction of eighth notes that zing and zip through the sky like a brass-winged bird up and away I'd fly. But the truth of the matter is I'd just as soon get wine high than risk Charlie's horn hitting the wrong vein.
And the title of that again is?
Charlie's Horn.
Charlie's Horn.
Yes.
So I want to ask, because I know many poets revisit their work. I think Whitman, obviously, whom Chris Foran referred to early on, sort of obsessively reworked Leaves of Grass right up until his death. This is a simple question, but it's also a very complicated one. When do you know it's done? When do you know the poem is finished? Allison, I'll start with you. Not an effortless question.
Mari Evans, Indianapolis poet, Black Arts Movement poet, and often reminded me that only you know as a poet. You know when it's finished. I don't know that I always know when it's finished, because I will go back and revise it. I mean, I will look and say, oh, that's a possible line break, but then it could break, you know, here as well. So I think I'm not ever satisfied, but I think I can bring closure to a poem, to satisfaction. I don't know. 10 years later, you return to a poem and you've changed, mm-hmm. not your view about the poem, and sometimes then the poem might change, but done is done when it's published, I think. So I'm in there.
How about you, Mitchell? Same question.
I think the poem at any time is like, it's done for now, especially when you're thinking about, you know, a book and putting it in a book, you know, you kind of let it go. I love to see poets like revise themselves as they read. I've seen that before. So, you know, that's totally up to the individual.
Yeah. Jessica, you're going to get the last word on this subject.
Well, I'm just echoing Allison and Mitchell. I mean, it feels done at a certain point, and you kind of push it out into the world, and then you look at it a couple years later, and you just think, I mean, I do. I look at poems later on, and I have ideas for changing. And
does it become its own thing after a while, where, you know, you can't necessarily take pride of ownership in it? Or
I think that's when I like them best, is when I don't feel like they're mine anymore. I just feel like they're this thing out there in the world, you know, independent of me at that point.
So it's a little bit like raising children and sending them out there.
I always call our books our babies. So, yeah. You know, it's, you know, and they have to be dressed properly before they go into the world. So that's part of it.
Well, I would like to thank all three of you for spending this time with us and for sharing your poetry with us. We will be back on Thursday with another live show. But I would like to thank my guests, Mitchell L.H. Douglas, the poet, author of Dying in the Scarecrow's Arms, Allison Horton, who is the author of Quick Fire, Jessica Reed, who is the author of World Composed, and we were joined earlier by Chris Forehand, who is the author of Black Leapt In. Obviously, we appreciate you spending the time with us to honor National Poetry Month, and I really enjoyed hearing your poetry and your stories. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.